Hello, and welcome to the Weekly News Roundup, a podcast of the Daily News. My name is Ann Brennan, and I'm Editor-in-Chief of the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. Each Friday, we discuss local stories that made the headlines with the reporters who covered them. Today, we'll talk about the Framingham Chief's decision to retire, the local tattoo industry, and Milford could be home to two huge apartment developments in the coming years. We're now joined by Jonathan Phelps and Allison Bosma. Hello, Jonathan and Allison.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you two had to put on your raincoats Monday with the runners and cover the marathon. So what was that like?
Yeah, it was more than a raincoat. I had rain pants and hat. I had like a hat on. It was really cold and very interesting. The rain started earlier than I thought. It was, you know, right at 6 a.m. It was pretty driving rain. So I was standing out there wondering what I was doing.
You sent a picture from the start line at about 6:30 that had snow on the ground.
Yeah, actually, when I left my house in Northborough, there was a good accumulation. But by the time I got to Hopkinton, it warmed up a little. But there was some snow on the ground. And the former lieutenant, one of the former lieutenants at the Hopkinton police, was joking that we could throw snowballs at each other because there was a little bit of a mound of snow right in front of the volunteer tent.
How about you, Allison?
Yeah, I put on about 6 layers of clothes, and they all got wet, which was great. I decided I was going to walk up and down Ashland's roughly 3-mile stretch of the marathon back and forth and not take shelter during my coverage time. So that was perhaps a poor decision because it was cold and it was raining and it was awful.
Well, and you wrote about, and you and Jonathan wrote about how hypothermia was a big problem during the on marathon day.
It was. A lot of runners had to drop out because of that. The medical tents saw a lot of attention. Mid-afternoon, there was something like 875 runners had been seen in the medical tents. And then they had to open up warming stations and send out, it was 20 buses to the sort of middle communities on the marathon route as extra warming centers.
I don't think those little kind of foil-looking things that they give them did much. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess they really do help, but I was at the start, and I think a lot of people were just a little over-optimistic and weren't kind of admitting to the fact that they were feeling cold and hypothermic. So I only witnessed one person that kind of threw his hands up and quit right at the start. So,
well, did you see Desiree Linden at the start? She won the race for women, the first American woman to do so since 1985.
Yeah, I saw them all lined up, but I didn't really have in my mind who might win. But they were all looking cold. I heard an interview that Shalane Flanagan was feeling it.
So there were spectators, not as many as usual, but there were spectators. What was the crowd like?
They were all really enthusiastic. I went by people who were fighting against the wind to set up their chairs and their tents and what have you. And a lot of people taking cover. Some people went inside between waves of runners, but for the most part, they were out there. I did talk to, or rather, one of our reporters talked to one police lieutenant who said that the crowds were not as big, it was in Natick specifically, as they've been before. But from what I saw, it was maybe a little thinner, but still really enthusiastic.
John, you talked to somebody, a police officer, I believe, who ran this race. From Hopedale?
Yeah, I spoke with Mario Sousa from Hopedale Police Department. I think he lives in Hopkinton with his family. He said it was just driving wind. He said there was one point in the race where he felt like he couldn't really move forward because the wind was kind of right in his face, and there was just so much rain. He just said it was really difficult. But their team for the Michael Lisnow Center, all 69 of their runners completed, and I have some interesting stats here. 27,042 runners started the race, and 25,822 finished the race. So the BAA says, despite all the conditions, 95.5% of the runners completed.
Yeah, it's a hard race to get into. You have to qualify and or raise something like $7,500 in order to be able to run, get a bib.
Yeah, it's a pretty lofty goal to get in.
So this was the 5th year anniversary of the marathon bombing. Was there, did you see anything? I know some people talked, some of our reporters talked to people about that. Was that a theme of this marathon, or were people more focused on the weather and everything else?
I asked a few people about that. I talked to some longtime volunteers, and they were volunteering, obviously 5 years ago, because they'd been volunteering for something like 15, 20 years. And they said things like I've run this before the bombings, and when that happened, I vowed never to run again, and that person stuck to it all the way to, this was an absolute tragedy, but everybody came together, and I'm really glad to see what the race is today, and sort of not moving past it, but seeing it as a source of strength.
Well, thank you, too. Thank you for braving the weather for us to get that story, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
We are now joined by Scott Causaleo on the phone from the Milford Daily News office. Hello, Scott.
Hey, how are you?
You recently wrote about local tattoo artists and how the tattoo industry has changed. What did you find out in your reporting?
So I found out that, first of all, one of the most surprising things to me that I wasn't aware of was that tattooing was illegal in Massachusetts until 2001 due to a hepatitis outbreak in New York City. In 1962, they outlawed it over in the Empire State, and then Massachusetts soon followed suit with that. So ever since 2001, when it was re-legalized, it's become this booming industry in Massachusetts.
Once it did become legal, like you say, the tattoo industry has really started to boom. And some of the trends that we're seeing is that local tattoo artists have gone from offering a certain specific template of designs, and now taking a more creative approach.
Yeah, so basically in the past, tattoos were really popular around the coast of Cape Cod, and there was tattoo parlors around there that would have, you know, just giant charts on the wall with different numbers and different designs that people would choose from, and they would get that tattoo. Oftentimes it would be couples on holiday, or you know, groups of friends looking to create a memento. But most recently, people have been more interested in making this more of a chapter in their life rather than a little page. So they're really thinking out their tattoos, and these artists are becoming more and more artistic, I guess is the only word. They're creating this custom work where people come in and with their own designs or ideas, and these tattoo artists will sketch them out and show them different sketches, show the clients different sketches, and they'll present them, and, you know, they'll be able to choose from there. And if clients bring in their own sketches, the artists usually always put on their own twist, their own artistic twist to those designs, and they're becoming a lot more intricate than they ever were before as artists learn how to work with skin more and more over paper, because the difference is huge.
And when you say the number on the wall, it would be, you know, like the, I don't know, the heart, the two hearts linked or whatever. They
right.
would say, I'd like a number one, or I'd like that design number two. Now they're saying,
right.
I want, there was one fellow you had had interviewed, wanted something tied back to his Scandinavian lineage.
Yeah, so this gentleman, his name was Jerry McCarthy. He's actually... he's a Natick resident who's a government contracted engineer technician at the U.S. Natick Soldier System Center, and he had a DNA test done recently where he found out and confirmed his Scandinavian descendancy. He had always been inspired by Viking tradition, so he decided to really adhere to it. And in that tradition, they put tattoos on the sides of their heads like that, and he went all for it.
Right,
very proud of it as well.
And one of the things that, you know, when I was growing up, there was a little bit of a stigma to having tattoos, but that seems to be gone at this point.
Yeah, so the stigmatization of tattoos has really declined in the last few years. It's what it was before was having a tattoo on open skin was considered bad for job interviews and, you know, just social stigmatization in general. Recently, it's become more of an expression of your life experiences, and people are more interested to ask about your tattoos now than they were before.
So how much are people paying for these tattoos? Did you find that out?
Yeah, so that ranges drastically. If we're talking about those wall number tattoos, they can be relatively cheap, especially on days like Valentine's Day where they have flash sales. But when it comes to those intricate tattoos, they can take hours or even months and cost between hundreds and thousands of dollars.
And say the flash sales of the templated version, what would that cost, like $50 or $100?
So that depends on where you go, but honestly, a lot of the places you go, you can get one of those flash tattoos for about $15.
Wow. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Scott. Maybe we'll see you at a tattoo parlor soon. We're now joined in the studio by Jim Hattadine. Hello, Jim.
Hi, good morning.
It looks like there's going to be a lot of work at the intersection of Edgehill Road, Edmonds Road, and Water Street in the near future.
Yeah, this is an area where there's been a lot of interest from people in the community for several years. You've got the Knobscot Shopping Plaza right there, which has been a target for redevelopment and maybe a major apartment and retail project in the future. And people also have had concerns about the congestion that already exists at this intersection. So the city has been planning to redesign or rebuild this intersection for a couple of years. Town meeting did set aside some money for the project last year. But we're kind of finally starting to see the city really move toward getting this project underway. I was at the Conservation Commission meeting last night where they got the approval from the environmental standpoint to do some road work there. So perhaps later this year you could see the project move forward. It has to do with widening the roads to make it a little easier for cars to get through and take turns, and also making it more suitable for pedestrians and cyclists.
Sounds like there's also going to be some detours to alleviate some of the traffic, hopefully, during the work.
Yeah, so the filing that the Department of Public Works had to do for the Conservation Commission didn't really need to lay out in detail kind of what the ins and outs of how construction is going to take place. But there was kind of an ominous line in this packet that said that traffic is going to be detoured during the project. So we don't know exactly how much of a headache that could be for people when that project gets underway, but it sounds like perhaps this year you could expect some detours on that in that series of roads, which is very heavily traveled.
And it sounds like it's going to be pedestrian and bicycle more friendly to pedestrians and bicyclists.
Yeah, the city adopted this complete streets philosophy, which has been rolled out across the state, which is kind of the mindset that if you're designing any kind of road work or, you know, designing roads or remaking the streets in your community, do it with the intent of making it work for not just vehicles, but people who use different modes of transportation. So they're applying that philosophy here with this project and trying to make it in a way that you're going to have wheelchair ramps to get on and off if you're, you know, using a wheelchair to go through this intersection. There's going to be a dedicated phase for pedestrians to cross the street, which is probably a little more hospitable than the way it's set up now. And you're going to have these share the road markings that are kind of supposed to give a little more visibility to cyclists who are traveling in and out of there.
Is this going to help with some type of development that might go into the old Knobscot Mall?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thinking is you're probably going to see some impact from any development that happens there in terms of an increase in the number of people coming and going through that intersection. And so people have thought for a long time, you know, you really need to do something with the intersection to facilitate that. There's also a proposal to put in a new school, maybe like a block away from this intersection to the west, the RCS Learning Center. I think that's the school got approval from the town for that last year, and I'm not sure exactly where they are in terms of getting that construction going. But there was a lot of fear at the time that the intersection couldn't handle the increase in buses and parents dropping off their kids from the school early in the morning and in the afternoon. So that was another reason that people, I think, really wanted to see some improvements at the intersection.
Any idea how long the work will take once it gets started?
I don't know that. As I said, there's not a lot of detail yet in terms of the ins and outs and how the project will go.
You had another story this week about a kiosk at Framingham State University where students can get a quick mental health screening.
So, yeah, the school has offered an online mental health screening tool for something like 20 years, and it uses a set of questions developed by a nonprofit from Wellesley that specializes in this. So the new hook to this is they have a physical kiosk that is in one of their buildings on campus in kind of a quiet corner, where if you're just walking by, you could stop and take one of these screening tests just to get a sense of, you know, do you have symptoms that might be consistent with a mental health disorder of some kind? And it's not meant to be a diagnostic tool, so you're not going to walk away with, you know, a hard and fast diagnosis that you need to seek treatment for XYZ. But it's to, you know, help you kind of understand a little bit better what might be beneficial and maybe point you to some mental health resources in the community or on the campus in particular.
And I understand that they also, that kiosk also will tell you where to go to get help if you meet some of the symptoms.
Yeah, they have, it's the same thing that you would find on their website. So once you get through it, you can email yourself a copy of kind of what the screening has suggested for you. And you can also click buttons to say, okay, here's where, if I'm a student at Framingham State, I can go, you know, get mental health treatment, or if I am looking for something in Framingham or nearby, you know, point you to different healthcare facilities.
And it was my understanding from your story that this kiosk is open to members of the community as well.
Yeah, that's the really neat thing is if you are at Framingham State and you're, you know, visiting or something for the day, you could do it if you're somebody who's, you know, casually stopping through. But the screening tool that's available online is also out there for members of the community to use. So that's a really neat asset that Framingham State is providing. They also have this mission of kind of more broadly raising awareness of the need for mental health services and kind of reducing the stigma around going through a screening like this and getting a sense of if there's a way that you know, you could get some emotional or support for different types of things.
We'll have the link to your story, and in your story, there's a link to where you can get help. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. I'm Ann Brennan. We're back on the Daily News Podcast with Christopher Gavin from our Milford Daily News office. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Ann.
This week, the Milford Zoning Board of Appeals held a public hearing on a proposed Stone Ridge development that will include 272 apartments on land near Interstate 495. What can you tell us about this?
Well, it's a proposal for what project developers are calling the residences at Stone Ridge. It's 272 apartments. 25% will be affordable under the state's affordable housing laws, known by many as simply Chapter 40B. Now, this is a site that has a long permitting history in town. The developers had set out 10 years ago to build a business park on the site. And as we all know, what happened after 2008, the market took a really big hit. The appetite for that kind of development went down, and they've had trouble trying to get tenants to sign on to it. They have one right now, Restaurant Depot, that's currently getting its building together. But basically, they've come back to the town and said that they want to put residences on half of the site and use the other half still as some commercial use. They believe that doing this mixed-use approach will make it a little bit more marketable for corporate tenants.
And this calls for, I believe, three separate buildings of apartments, this project?
Yes, there's three five-story buildings.
What is the response of the zoning board members?
Well, right now, as you mentioned, they just started the process in this project on Wednesday night. From what we gathered right now, the chairman of the board, Dave Consigli, did say that he would like to see some of the information updated. They presented a map of wetlands on the site that basically hadn't been updated since 2007. So he said he understands that the developer has a long history with the site, that their board is sensitive to what they want to do with it. They've been through this every which way, but they do want to see updated information. And there's been a lot of talk, not just between the board members, but in town, about how the water infrastructure is going to handle a proposed connection to a site of this size. It should be noted that there are two other comparable developments being proposed in town, very similar to this one, and they all want to connect to the water supply in Milford, which you can ask basically anyone in town who has a connection that there's a lot of problems with it. There's not as much going around. So there's going to be a lot of improvements that are needed from the infrastructure, and they kind of asked the developers about that at the meeting on Wednesday night. They said they are still kind of looking over what they received back from the Milford Water Company, and basically town officials just really want them to make sure they have their stuff when they come back to the board next.
So the board is or Zoning Board of Appeals is looking to the developer to make some of these upgrades. That would be part of the deal for building?
Not necessarily so. I don't think they've reached that point yet, saying who's going to do what. But they just said that, you know, they believe that there is some capacity in the system to take on some more users, but it's going to require a lengthy repair process, and it's going to be pretty costly to get the system up to that point.
Well, one of the other developments that you is a 40B development is the Birch Street Place, four residential buildings. What's that about, and where is that in the pipeline of construction?
Well, Birch Street just filed a plan for their comprehensive permit with the town. I want to say it was earlier this month, though I could be a little wrong with that just because there are a lot of balls up in the air with very similar projects. So they're just starting out. Something very similar that they're proposing 162 rental apartments. What's different about this project so far is that it has been talked about as the idea has come to fruition a little bit more before town boards already. So the planning board and the board of selectmen were already privy to what the developer is trying to do here. The developer is Kevin Lobeser. He owns 88 Corp, which is behind it. He's the president. He's a local guy who's actually just won a bid on buying the former Middle School East. As Milford residents will know, he's looking to turn into housing for those 55 years and older. So a local guy, people know pretty well. He's done a lot of projects in town. So the town's already been pretty engaged in this process. So what is being proposed, I don't think it comes as much of a surprise to anyone in this case.
And that's located in the downtown area, correct?
The Middle School East is in the downtown area, correct. Birch Street is closer to 495 off of Route 109.
Okay. Well, another story that you've been reporting, and actually for about the last month, there's more fallout from the incident of a public official making inappropriate, some say racist, comments during an inspection. The Board of Selectmen voiced their concerns in the wake of an apology by Board of Assessors member Joseph Arcudi, who apologized for making those statements. One person at the meeting described the task force as overkill.
Yeah, what I can say here, I think it's worth noting, Joseph Arcudi did apologize earlier this month for making what has been described as vulgar and aggressive comments. He stopped short of saying whether or not he remembers saying anything that some have interpreted to be racist. There was a quote, according to an eyewitness, of, these people are pigs, deport them all. Whereas ICE, that was said during this building inspection. Basically, the Board of Health was taken aback, as many other folks in town have been, and they've questioned a little bit of how this neighborhood task force goes about on conducting these inspections. There was 10 town officials there, and then 11 people, when you add in the landlord, who were there, and as one of the members of the board told me last week, it just seemed a little like overkill to him to have so many people going on these kinds of calls.
And there are members who are members of the Neighborhood Task Force, and then Mr. Arcudi is not, but he went along anyway, and there were other officials who did similarly, correct?
Right. So the Neighborhood Task Force is a group of different departments in town that is commissioned by the Board of Selectmen to go on these reviews, usually after they receive a complaint from a neighbor. Everyone else there who was on that inspection, from what I can tell, was supposed to be there, but Mr. Arcudi, who's lifelong resident in town and a member of the Board of Assessors, did go on. He said that he wasn't a member of the task force, but he did go on the inspection out of his own concern. You're correct when you say that.
And that's one of the things they're trying to work out now, whether they're going to continue to allow that type of that number of people to go on these and maybe keep it to a smaller group.
Yeah, I mean, in regards to that aspect of it, I mean, the rest is it remains to be seen. The Board of Selectmen did just get a new chairman following the election. Mike Walsh, who told me he intends to look at the Neighborhood Task Force and how it conducts its business as he moves through his tenure here. So whatever comes next is, like I said, remains to be seen.
Well, thank you for joining us, Chris.
Thanks for having me in.
Joined by Zane Razak. Hello, Zane.
Hey, he's throwing me back.
You wrote a wonderful feature about Chef Luckman Pierre of Sudbury, who's about to work his magic at a prestigious dinner. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I got to spend the day with him in his Sudbury home. He made a kale salad with shrimp, and it was really exciting to be there and watch a professional chef at work.
Despite the horrible weather so far this spring, there are signs that better weather is ahead of us. Crocuses are springing up, and the Medway Drive-In has opened.
Yes. Yes, I was really excited to write that article. I got to spend the day with the general manager at the Mendon Drive-In, Michael Neville, and he was just showing me about the drive-in and what kinds of movies they're going to be showing this year and how they keep excitement up there.
Right. The tenor of your story, or what part of what your story was about, was how smaller theaters like the drive-in and a couple other theaters are, creating an experience for moviegoers to kind of compete with the multiplex theaters.
Yep. So the drive-in in Mendon does these really exciting, elaborate events that he was telling me about. The one that stuck out to me was the one from last year for the horror movie It, which was about a clown just killing kids.
In the sewer, right? In the storm drain, right?
Yes, by Stephen King. And so for that movie, they had a big carnival. He was telling me about how there were clowns kind of hiding out and jumping out at people and things that you couldn't do at a regular multiplex.
And there were some other theaters that as well. There was one that I can't remember the name of it, but they play older movies and have quite a crowd that comes to watch those.
Yep. That was the Fine Arts Theater in Maynard. And yeah, that one was also really cool to see. It's like a historic building. The building itself has been there since the 1800s, and the theater was started in the 40s. Everyone should go check it out because it's a really cool building and has a very vintage look. And it's very, when you're driving by, you definitely notice it. The sign is, red and bright cursive, and it's just really cute.
Well, thank you, Zane. There'll be pictures and other things on the show notes with this podcast about the theaters, where they're located, and what they're offering.
Yep.
Thank you.
Great.
We're now joined by Norman Miller. Hello, Norm.
Hi, how are you?
Well, on Wednesday evening, we got news that Framingham Police Chief Ken Ferguson plans to retire as of April 27th. Was that a surprise, or was it expected?
He said it was expected. I think it was something I know a lot of people, just from people talking at the office. A lot of people thought he was going to retire last year after he had that long medical episode when he was out. And I asked him that last night. He goes, he just didn't want to go out that way. He wanted to go out on his own terms and come back and work and see the transition from a town to a city. I know he announced it to the department last night at 6:30 p.m. in an email. So I think it was kind of maybe not totally unexpected, but the timing of it kind of was.
Right, and his last day is going to be April 27th. So
yeah,
it's
next Friday. It's pretty week and a half from when he tells the department till when he's gone.
So his tenure has not been without problems, however.
No.
He has been with the department for 34 years, starting as an officer and worked his way up the ranks.
Yeah. I mean, since he became chief, there have been some few issues, some lawsuits. There was the issue with the evidence officer who was eventually convicted for stealing money from the evidence room. But you're right, he has been from the department for 34 years. He did a lot of, the planning, crimes, plotting where crimes happen, this is where we strategically deploy officers here, there, and that. He did a lot of developing of that. He's really been like a lifelong police officer. He used to go to his father was a police officer in Framingham. He used to go to the department with his father as a child. He basically grew up. I've been today speaking to people who work with him over the years, and everyone says the same thing. He's like a real, he's the kind of person you want to have, working with you, because he's very smart, very nice, a very good person to speak to. He's very smart, and he'll go out of his way to make sure things go right. So everyone thinks he's been a great officer over the years and has been a really, really a benefit to the Framingham Police Department.
But there have been a couple of lawsuits by officers?
Yeah, a couple officers disputes. Former Deputy Chief Kevin Slattery, I believe Sergeant Scott Brown. There has been some issues over the last few years involving some employees.
And their work issues.
Yeah, and it's things that happened at the state department.
Framingham Mayor Yvonne Spicer and Ferguson held a press conference on Thursday to talk about this. We'll make the announcement more formal.
Yeah, she talked about that she's going to be appointing an interim chief soon. She didn't indicate who it was going to be. I know when Chief Ferguson was out on medical leave, Deputy Chief Stephen Trask, who's the senior deputy chief, was served as interim chief. I'm waiting to hear back about what she expects the process to be to go forward after interim chief. Is it going to be an in-house search? Is it going to be open search nationally throughout New England? That's some of the things we're hoping to find out, how she's going to go about for looking for the next chief.
She mentioned that she was going to talk to some other similar-sized police departments to see what their process was when they were looking for or recruiting a new chief.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because this is obviously the first chief and first real major position of someone leaving since the Framingham switched over from a town to a city. Before, it was basically a town. They'd have advertised their chief, go in front of the town manager, and then the board of selectmen, and then they voted. And now with the mayor, it's a totally different process. So it's going to be interesting to see how that's going to work out.
Well, Mayor Spicer said that she'd like to continue to add more community policing and coordination with having the police coordinate with local social service agencies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of police departments are looking to do a lot more community policing. So I think that makes sense. That's what she's going to be looking for, someone who really puts community policing near the top of what she's looking for.
We had some sad news from Cape Cod last week. Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon was shot and killed while attempting to serve a warrant in Marston's Mills. His funeral was on Wednesday, and several police officers from Metro West and Milford were among the, what I would say, an army of law enforcement officers who attended the funeral. What did you hear from the local officers?
Oh, I got anecdotally that every department from our area had police officers going, but specifically I spoke to Ashland. Their canine officer, Sergeant Chris Alberini, actually trained with Officer Gannon. They're both canine officers, so he went down there and he brought his dog Dax as part of the services down there. Framingham sent a large contingent. They sent members of the Honor Guard as well of several motorcycle police officers to help with traffic and the procession, and as well as 10 officers to take part. One of those was Sergeant Phil Hurton from Framingham, who was actually shot in the face in an incident about 9 years ago this month, like within 2 days of the anniversary, was when Officer Gannon was shot and killed. And I spoke to him the other day, and he was saying whenever something like this happens, really brings back how close he came, because the bullet was lodged right next to, I believe it was his aorta, and he came really close to dying. It was featured on a show on ABC at the time. They happened to be at the hospital the night he came in there. They're filming, so you really got to see when they were talking about how close he came to dying. It's not just him saying this, is what the doctors were saying that night. It was just, he got lucky, but he said it just reminds you how no matter what, it seems it could be the most, from the outside, looks like a routine thing, serving a warrant or a traffic stop or anything, how quickly something like that could change.
Officer Gannon's canine partner, Nero, was also shot as well, but he was released from the hospital on Wednesday, the same day as the funeral.
Yeah, Nero went home. I know a lot of people from looking at social media were very excited about that.
Right. He was shot in the head and I think another part of his body. I understand that retired Yarmouth Police canine officer Peter McClellan stayed with Nero at the hospital just about the whole time, if not the whole time. He's going to care for the dog until he's fully healed. And then I guess Nero's going to go live with somebody in the Gannon family.
Oh, I mean, the police dogs become parts of the family. Every time I speak to officers about the dogs, I mean, they care about them just as much as any other partner on the force.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Weekly News Roundup. You can find links to the stories, photos, and video we spoke about with the show notes for this episode. The Daily News podcast can be found in the Apple App Store, Google Play, and on the Metro West Daily News and Milford Daily News websites. Thank you to Kate and Kelleher for producing and editing this episode. Be sure to listen to the Daily News podcast on Tuesday when Caitlin chats with members of the community. And listen to our Beer for Everyone project with the beer nut Norman Miller and his colleague and friend Nicole Simmons, which is also posted on Fridays. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us next week.